Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Heard around the state on Utah Public Radio, I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the program, tragedy strikes at the University of Utah as a student athlete is murdered on campus. We'll hear how Lauren McCluskey is being remembered. Also, this week's debate in the 3rd Congressional District race reveals stark differences between the candidates. Members of the Ute Mountain Ute Tribe express concern about water pollution near a Utah uranium mill, and more. Joining me for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune editor Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Welcome, Jennifer. Good morning.
Good morning.
We've also got reporter Courtney Tanner in studio with us, and welcome, Courtney. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
And reporter Taylor Stevens. Hello and welcome, Taylor.
Thank you.
I called you Taylor Stevens this time.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Join the conversation, listeners, by calling 801-355-8255 or comment at sltrib.com at the Behind the Headlines page that is live there right now. Again, the number is 801-355-8255. Well, we will start today with a tragedy that occurred Monday evening, the shooting death of University of Utah student athlete Lauren McCluskey. Courtney Tanner, this is a story that you helped cover. Who was Lauren McCluskey, and can you lay out the facts of what happened to her, how this tragedy unfolded on Monday?
Lauren McCluskey was a student at the University of Utah. She was also on the track team, 21 years old, a recruit from Pullman, Washington. And on Monday evening, she was found dead inside of a car. Police say that Melvin Rowland, who she had dated for about a month, is the person responsible for that.
She met Rowland at a bar where he was a bouncer, sort of security at the bar. In September, they struck up this relationship, but he was hiding a number of things from her: his real name, his real age, the fact that he had a criminal history as well. What was the criminal history, Courtney?
He is a registered sex offender. In 2004, he was convicted of a couple offenses there.
Okay, and Lauren McCluskey discovered this, and she called off the relationship. It had just been a few weeks. And then he began harassing her, I understand. Is that correct?
That's right. So she received a couple of text messages and emails. At first, she didn't know if it was Rowland or his friends. Police later did say it was all Rowland. These messages were kind of suspicious, and some of them were harassing. And then at one point, they were extorting her. She ended up paying $1,000 on one threat so that the person behind these texts wouldn't release compromising pictures of her and Rowland. Mm.
All of this was reported to the police, right? She reported this harassing behavior to University of Utah campus police, correct?
That's right. So she ended their relationship on October 9th, and then a day later she was in contact with police to retrieve her car, which Rowland had borrowed from her. And then on October 12th and October 13th, she reported the harassing messages to police, and they didn't open an investigation, a formal investigation, until 6 days later.
Do we know why it took as long as it took for that investigation to be opened?
The police chief at the U said yesterday that his detectives were busy on other cases.
Hmm. Robert Gerke, Salt Lake Tribune columnist, has a column this morning. He pins quite a bit of the blame on the breakdown of communication between police and corrections officials as being sort of responsible for this young woman's death. And Jennifer Napier-Pierce, editor of the Salt Lake Tribune, I don't know if you want to weigh in on this, but it's a tragic situation where information is not being shared, and I mean, you can draw a pretty direct line there.
Yeah, I think the governor announced that the state would investigate through the Department of Corrections. Gotcha. University of Utah President Ruth Watkins said they were going to investigate their protocols with university police. But, I mean, it is really shocking to look at the timeline. If you haven't seen it, go to sltrib.com. It goes through detailed what we know, at least so far, that there was a six-day gap between McCluskey's claim that this guy was harassing her and there was some extortion before the police even got to it. And then the questions start to go, well, what did the police actually do when they launched this so-called investigation? You know, they were not aware that this guy was on parole. How deep did their investigation go? I think that the question marks around this case will take us to some places that we may not want to go. You know, I do think that at this point, it looks like University of Utah police really dropped the ball on a cry for help, and with really tragic consequences for the entire community.
The timeline you mentioned is available at sltrip.com. It's got all sorts of interesting details about, I mean, the fact that he was essentially lurking on campus trying to find her for a number of days. Roland was found by police after a tip from a woman he met on an online dating site, someone who had actually picked him up on campus. This is after the murder had been committed. And he went and had dinner with her, et cetera. Police tracked him down, followed him downtown Salt Lake City, and then he tried to break into a church, or he did break into a church, and shot himself and died. Courtney, let's move on from the tragedy itself to how Lauren McCluskey herself is being remembered. You attended a vigil on Wednesday at the U. A number of her track and field teammates were there. How were they remembering Lauren? How was she described at this vigil?
Yeah, it was really hard for these teammates to even talk about her, to get the words out. A lot of them, you know, got up to the podium and just cried. I mean, I think that's how deep the connection to Lauren was in this community and on her team. But they remembered her, you know, for being a really driven athlete, for always showing up to practice at exactly 1:15 p.m., never being late to that. Her coach remembered her for always being on his top 10 board for student GPAs on the team. He never had to replace her name on that every semester, so...
There were tributes, various athletic programs. I think all of the university athletics programs were in attendance at this vigil, right?
That's right. And a couple other teams from across the state and across the country. So UCLA's soccer team was there for a game, and they showed up to this vigil. A couple people from Westminster's track team were there.
And just to say that there is such solidarity among the student athletes, BYU's team, of course, arch rivals of the University of Utah, they wore red. A number of other teams did on the day. Donovan Mitchell from the Utah Jazz wore red sneakers as a tribute to Lauren. So I think that in a lot of ways, this is a model student, a model citizen with a bright future. And that's what is just the sucker punch, right?
Yeah. How is her, I know that she was on the phone with her mom when she was being abducted, before she was murdered. How has her family been responding to that kind of outpouring from, you know, universities, from people like Donovan Mitchell, who again, as Jen said, wore these sneakers with her name on them, I think, even at the same time. You know, how is her family, obviously they're suffering.
Sure. And they were, her parents were at the vigil Wednesday night, obviously upset, but, you know, hugging the team and standing with the track team there.
I mean, the fact that this was a campus shooting, it's less than a year from another campus shooting at the University of Utah, that drew a lot of attention to it. Jennifer Napier Pierce, obviously there are other examples of domestic violence, of intimate partner violence, of murder that occur, you know, far too often, but this really struck a chord here in our community.
Well, you're right. I mean, 2 in 2 years, that doesn't happen at many campuses across the country. I think the University of Utah needs to look deep and reevaluate campus safety. How can parents have confidence that their kids are going to be safe when they send their kids off to school in the fall? How can students feel like they have a safe place to be on campus? And, you know, the University of Utah, it's growing. It's almost like a renewing empire. You go up there, there's construction everywhere. So there's this optimism, but is there something else that this growth is missing? When you are inviting more students to live on campus, do you need a change of thinking when you are thinking about campus security? I'm at that point where I'm sending kids off to college, and a lot of campuses have alert systems. There's like blue towers where you can phone, you know, somebody right away. Yeah. I think the University of Utah may need to start thinking more seriously about its security plans.
You know, I just have to say that as you know, something that struck me from this whole event is that the number of people who have come forward and said, I'm constantly looking over my shoulder, or I'm on the phone with my mom or my contact at night. And most of the people who are saying that are women. It's not something that I regularly think about, a position of privilege to be in, I think, in this day and age.
Yeah, I think Bagley has a great cartoon about that today. Yes. It's just, you know, a dude with his cell phone, he's listening to music on his way to the parking lot. In the same frame, there's a woman who's like clutching her bag, looking around her furiously, like trying to make sure that she's safe. I think that's the reality that women have in America. I guess I just grew up with that, so I haven't really thought about it. But yeah, I mean, I'm always safety conscious, and I think that it's sad commentary on a society right now.
Yeah, what's normal for you is not what's normal for me. Courtney, how close was Laura McCluskey to graduating? I mean, she was a senior, is that right?
She was a senior. She was going to graduate in this coming spring, 2019. So the university has responded by posthumously giving her parents the degree that Lauren would have earned. Mm-hmm. And the track team has also given her parents a framed jersey, which is given to athletes who finish their eligibility at the school.
Wow. And do we know what her future plans would have been, what she was thinking about doing? Not part of the reporting that's been done, I don't think, so far. Okay.
There are so many threads to this story, Roger. I mean, we will continue to report this completely because, again, it's one woman's tragedy. It's one family's tragedy, but it has so many different aspects to it that range from campus safety to the way police handle these complaints. You know, do they take these complaints of harassment and extortion seriously, or as seriously as they should? Mm-hmm. What's the relationship between local police and the parole board?
Right.
You know, how many times should somebody be let go from a prison situation? We know that this man was in and out of prison.
And given a certain degree of leniency at one point.
Yes, indeed. I mean, we've got the tapes. I just think this has far-reaching implications for the entire community. So we're going to stay on it.
Well, the Tribune's reporting has been on point. Tough to cover tragedy. Courtney, just as an example, reading your articles, the focus on remembering who Lauren was is really standout stuff. Check it all out at sltrib.com. Let's head to our first break of the show, and we will come back and cover more from this past week's news. This is Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We will be back in just a minute.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I am joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune editor Jennifer Napier-Pierce and reporters Courtney Tanner and Taylor Stevens. This is our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments. We are at 801-355-8255. You can also post them at the Behind the Headlines page at sltrib.com. Taylor Stevens, you covered the latest debate from the Utah Debate Commission this past week. This was in the third congressional district race, which is a race between John Curtis and James Singer, Republican John Curtis and Democrat James Singer. And I understand that they were pretty far apart on their policy prescriptions and political philosophies. What were the big divisions between these candidates, Taylor?
So Curtis is, you kind of have to understand that he is lobbying for his first full term. So he took over when Rep. Jason Chaffetz left kind of midterm.
Yeah.
And so he's asking voters to give him kind of a full chance to accomplish the things that he started. He's been in there for, I think, 11 months or
right.
so. And so what kind of the major difference that emerged at this debate was, and Curtis kind of has this limited government philosophy, which makes sense being a Utah Republican.
Right.
He's very much for states' rights. And, you know, you also have James Singer, who has kind of this populist message, who is trying to advocate for an enlarged social safety net. And you see this difference really play out throughout the debate in the policy positions that they take. For example, on medical marijuana, you have Curtis saying, you know, this is really a state's issue. States should take the reins on this and keep in mind public safety, keep in mind the legitimate medical concerns. Whereas Singer says, you know, the federal government should really be legalizing this
as a
nationwide
yeah.
and possibly recreationally. And he kind of ties this to efforts to reduce the number of people who are incarcerated. He's concerned about mass incarceration in this country and in efforts to help reduce that by decriminalizing, in his case, legalizing marijuana nationwide.
Completely different positions on role of government, on medical marijuana. Climate change was another place where these two candidates had starkly different views.
Exactly, yeah. Curtis really fell kind of short of acknowledging the human role in climate change at this debate. He has this view that if you use that word, it's polarizing, that you bifurcate a room. And so he really wants to talk to Utahns about being good stewards rather than this kind of national climate crisis. And he kind of believes that solutions to this are going to come on the individual level. He kind of gave the example of, you know, if you drive your car the two blocks to church, if you take multiple cars to church, that maybe you should be kind of on an individual level looking at your own actions and making some changes. And I think that Singer would likely advocate for individuals to be, you know, cognizant of their own actions as well. But he really sees the solutions to the climate crisis, which he said after the debate is his number one issue. He says nothing else matters if we can't address this climate crisis because we won't be here, he says. And so for him, he really sees the solutions to this as more of a systemic kind of business-oriented approach. So he wants to see a carbon tax, for example. He wants to see kind of actions at the top down rather than actions at the bottom up.
The closest that these two candidates came may have been on immigration policy. Can you talk about that, Taylor? Singer, for example, had something to say about his Navajo heritage on this topic, and they were both advocating for a degree of, I guess, civility or compassion?
Yeah, I think that this is an issue in Utah that, you know, we see a lot of agreement around kind of with the state's LDS heritage and the pioneers and persecution. And so on the immigration issue, they both have some similarities. And Curtis said that it's one of his major frustrations during his time in Congress that his Republican colleagues have not addressed the issue of immigration. And Singer kind of came back and said, you know, this is why it's strategic to vote for me, because the Democratic Party is actively advocating for solutions to this issue, he says. And so he thinks that it's going to be easier for him to have a platform to accomplish something on this issue. He did bring his Navajo heritage in, as was brought up kind of frequently throughout the debate, interestingly.
This is Jennifer Napier-Pierce, just to get your opinion on this. I mean, this is such a different debate than some that we have seen where the candidates have, you know, even candidates from opposing parties have not seemed to be on wildly different sides of things. I don't know. It's interesting. Actually, before you respond to that, Taylor, how does the polling in this race look?
Yeah, so it seems that Curtis has a pretty clear path to re-election. A recent Salt Lake Tribune Hinckley Institute of Politics poll found that Curtis has a 54-point lead, which I think is one of the largest leads that we're seeing in any of the congressional races. And so Singer, I think, had 13% of the vote to Curtis's 67% of the vote. So it seems like he has a pretty clear path, although Singer is confident that people are going to come out to vote for him that maybe haven't been registered in the past or who have been disenfranchised or marginalized.
This guy is running a campaign on a shoestring. I don't think I've ever seen a candidate so lean and mean. And I think he was waiting for the debate to really heighten his profile. I agree with you, Roger. There are not too many candidates with so much sunlight between them. You know, they're very, very different. And so as voters in this very conservative district, you do have a pretty clear choice. Yeah. I thought both were articulate. They gave voters things to think about. And sometimes you leave the debate thinking, I don't know what I just heard, or, you know, what is the difference here? I don't think there's any mistake what the difference is here. James Singer is very much part of the young up and coming Democratic Socialist type, very much in the Bernie Sanders camp. And then you've got Mr. Curtis, who is a former Provo mayor, and he's much more of the moderate Republican that you would expect to see here. So yeah. I thought as interestingly divided they were on the issues, it actually was a very cordial and respectful
Absolutely.
Environment, which, again, when you have people who are so far apart on a lot of different issues, you might expect a little bit more tension and negative energy.
Which we have seen in other debates,
I think. We absolutely have.
Maybe
yeah.
you don't have to bring out the claws when you're 54 points ahead.
Yeah, that's true.
Good
that's
point.
True.
Has Jennifer Napier Pierce, editor of the Salt Lake Tribune, this kind of dovetails into something else that I want to briefly talk about, which is political endorsements. The Tribune editorial board has not weighed in on this particular race.
Not yet.
Yet. Okay. Stay tuned. Maybe we'll see if that comes. The board has endorsed some candidates, though. Salt Lake County District Attorney Sim Gill just this morning, for example. Also Shireen Ghorbani in the Democratic candidate, who is the Democratic candidate in the second congressional district race, where she's challenging incumbent Republican Chris Stewart. There were a couple of endorsements that I think were maybe surprising to some people, at least. Tribune editorial board endorsed both Mitt Romney and Mia Love. And Jennifer, can you talk to us about these endorsements? One place we might start is the fact that not all newspapers engage in political endorsements. Why does the Tribune?
No, that's fair. The Tribune has kind of a checkered past when it comes to endorsements. They've done it for a long time, and they've also taken breaks from doing it.
Yeah.
So it really is the prerogative of the owner and publisher whether or not we want to weigh in on things. I think the reason why is twofold. First, we have we get to sit down with all of these candidates in a way that I think members of the general public may not. They come in, they talk to the editorial board at length, at least an hour, sometimes longer, about an entire menu of issues. And so that sort of one-on-one interaction may give some nuance to some of the candidates that you don't see on the political ads and things like that. So we want to share what we've learned as an editorial board. So there's that. The second piece, I think, is we're like voters trying to put it all together. When you read strings of stories, this is a snapshot in time. And the editorial board is really trying to, like the voters, make sense of the world. we're trying to put all of those pieces together and to come to some conclusions about what we think. So, you know, I think you can say that in this modern era, there's a very good argument. Why are you even doing this?
Yeah.
But I think that there are arguments and valid ones to say that this has value to the community. It is trying to inform voters in a different way than our regular reporting does.
I dug up, there was this, you mentioned the checkered past where the Tribune did and didn't. I dug up an old Associated Press story that points to former Tribune publisher Jack Allivan giving up on political endorsements after the paper endorsed Richard Nixon.
Yep.
And then the Watergate scandal happened. He said, we're going to get rid of this. Is the editorial board all yelling at each other? I mean, how are you? Yesterday on the KCBW political show, both sides of the aisle, Senator Jim DeBacchus on the left said, you know, this is all about Paul Huntsman making decisions. And then there was a guest host, James Evans, former chair of the Republican Party in the state of Utah. And he said, no, this is the editorial board deliberating and coming up with an answer. Are you guys drawing straws? What's happening, Jen?
The drawing straws comes into who has to draw the short straw to actually write it. No, I mean, we all have very strong opinions, and we're coming at issues and people from different places. We're not yelling most of the time.
Okay. I remember that it was national news when the Tribune endorsed President Obama for re-election. Whoever you endorse, you are bound to anger some segment of your readers.
Well, I mean, I think you saw the strongest reaction to our Mia Love, Ben McAdams endorsement that came out earlier this week. The reaction can be tracked very closely to the polls. How close are these races? And people really care about that race. And so,
whereas in the Mitt Romney,
either way, I was going to get yelled at. I mean, there's no question. If I had endorsed Ben McAdams, the outrage would have come my way too. I'm glad to see that people care. That's the third thing that endorsements do. They really are aimed at sparking conversations and getting people invested. I mean, these are big choices. And so I hope that people will either take a look at it and say, I just absolutely disagree with you, or, you know, good on you. So
do you think they have an effect on how people vote? I mean, endorsements in the long?
I don't know. I mean, I think that might be a little egotistical. Really, I think this is food for thought for the voters. The dynamics of the election have changed so dramatically, though, because of mail-in voters, early voting. So at this point, you know, a lot of people have already voted. So by the time the endorsement comes out for
that particular or for
in the last race, it's like, well, gee, you know, I've already cast my vote. Who cares?
Readers can check out the endorsements at the opinion section of sltrib.com. We do have a comment here. Marty in West Valley City, who called in, says Tribb said they endorsed Love because of her experience in Congress and what she has accomplished. What exactly has she accomplished is the question. Marty is not on the line, though. He just left that question for you. Jen, I mean, you are the representative of the editorial board.
Sure.
Here. Can you address that?
I think one thing that she does that's unique in our Utah delegation is she has demonstrated bipartisanship in a way that nobody else in the delegation has. When you look at a straight Republican, straight Mormon delegation going to Washington, she does offer at least a willingness to consider the other side. That was something that, as an editorial board, we really like to see. She is part of the Congressional Black Caucus. She serves on the Climate Solutions Caucus. Again, she's favoring Dreamers. She wants to keep families, immigrant families, together. She has expressed her dismay to President Trump in a way that I think is admirable. So, I mean, as an editorial board, we really want her to show, a willingness for consensus and for bridge building. We think that she's done that, and we want her to continue to do that.
I can imagine Marty in West Valley City saying, but Jen, you're pointing to sort of positions as opposed to accomplishments themselves. What about the Tribune editorial, if I remember correctly, says that both of them should stay where they are. Ben McAdams would be better served staying as Salt Lake County Mayor. I don't know. That was just part of what you said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We think he's doing an excellent job. And so we do think that he is well suited in the position where he is.
Okay. Before we head to another break, we have just one more call. Caller coming in. This is Mike in Salt Lake City, who has a comment on the topic that we are covering right now. Mike in Salt Lake City, go ahead. What's your question?
Hi, yes. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Of course.
Ms. Pierce, I'm one of the individuals who's a little disappointed in the Tribune's endorsement. In your recent comments, just barely, you talk about one of Mia Love's strengths being that she is bipartisan or is, willing to walk across the aisle. I don't know, have you driven along I-15 lately and seen all of the billboards that say Pelosi equals Ben McAdams? And could you explain to me, in the lens that you just offered about bipartisanship, how that actually how you can reconcile that?
Well, again, I am not part of either of these campaigns. My reconciliation, I guess, comes from the difference between statesmanship and candidacy. There is a distinct difference. Obviously, this is a nasty political fight for each of their lives. It's gotten negative on both sides. Money is pouring in like crazy from national groups. I don't know who paid for those particular billboards. I'm not going to defend them. All I can say is that, at least in her actions during her tenure, she has demonstrated a willingness to go across the aisle and to look for solutions. We need more people in Washington like that.
Mike, can I just, before we head to a break here, and if you can make it quick, I'd like to ask you, do you think that the Tribune's editorial is going to impact voters? Is that something that you are concerned about?
Oh, no, I don't think it's going to impact voters. I do believe that the Tribune's base is individuals like me. So what I do think it's going to do is impact the Tribune and its ability to be a functional newspaper in our community.
Okay. Thank you very much for your comments. We really appreciate it. And Jen, again, as you pointed out, a lot of passion on this debate and people with concerns about the Tribune and the editorial stance that it takes. To me, it makes me, I wonder if you ever re-question whether or not you should be doing political endorsements as a result. But this
absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think about it constantly. And I think other newspapers have thought about that as well. You know, at this point, we're going to continue to do it. I will say, you know, we endorsed an independent in Congressional District 1. We endorsed the Democrat in Congressional District 2. You know, we are trying to look for people who we think represent Utah values in Washington and can, like, shake up the gridlock that's just, like, totally plaguing our nation's capital.
Okay. Again, you can check these endorsements out at the opinion section of sltrib.com. Let's head to another quick break, and when we return, we'll squeeze in one more news item before we turn to our underplayed stories and then a recorded feature. You are listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Jennifer Napier-Pierce, Taylor Stevens, and Courtney Tanner. It's our Friday morning news roundup. You can join us with your questions and comments at 801-355-8255. Taylor Stevens, I want to turn to some reporting that you did on the environmental impacts of the Inland Port Project. This is the project that's going to be built out by the Great Salt Lake. That is a planned project that is an inland port. Can you give us a sense of what the fears are about the port when it comes to how it will impact our air, our health, and the ecosystem?
Yeah, so like you said, this is a planned development, so it hasn't actually gone through yet. We're really in the starting phases of this. But, and so keeping that in mind, we don't have an environmental impact study yet. We don't have a business plan yet. So it's really hard to say, you know, what are the environmental impacts going to be? But when we're looking at this, you know, environmental experts and advocates are saying that even under their best case scenarios, they're worried this is going to worsen air quality and is going to impact people's health, as you've said. So some of the concerns is that this port, it would be a development hub, and it's expected to bring increased rail, truck, air traffic, which brings with it more tailpipe emissions. And so the state has already struggled to meet federal ozone limits. And when you take into account the booming growth that we're expected to see over the next 20 years, then that's already an increased emissions even without the port. And so people are concerned, particularly with the Great Salt Lake ecosystem, that with this built so close, the Great Salt Lake has already decreased to half the size that it was in 1847 when the pioneers came. Mm. And so people are already sensing that this is an ecosystem on the brink of destruction.
Of collapse, essentially. You spoke to a number of people who, or at least a couple of people who had that fear that this might be, you know, building a port there, I guess in an inappropriate way, might send the lake into turmoil.
Exactly. And advocates are pushing for the port to be net zero, meaning it would create as much energy in renewables as it would use. But, you know, some people like Salt Lake City Mayor Jackie Biskupski are really unsure that there's the political will to do this. And
can I ask, I mean, net zero, this is talking specifically to buildings, not for, you know, emissions from trucks coming and showing up or from the increased traffic in the area. Or, I mean, when we say net zero, we mean a net zero port in terms of the amount of energy that it's generating.
I think they want to see net zero in terms of emissions. And so in that case, I believe that they would want to see the amount of renewable energy used enough to offset not only the building energy, but also the energy from just the total emissions of the port. So I think that it is a lofty goal, and some have realized it's a bit idealistic. They're pushing for this to be as renewable and as sustainable as possible. And the port board, Derek Miller, the chairman, has said that this is something that they're considering. It's really in its early phases, and so it's really hard to say
Concern also about wildlife, birds in particular, birds who need the Great Salt Lake. We talked about the potential collapse of this ecosystem from some people that you spoke with. This is a, birds need this lake to survive, according to some people you've spoken to, and if they don't have it, they won't.
Yeah, and we're seeing these kind of ecosystems like the Great Salt Lake, others throughout the country are also being impacted by water diversion, by human use and impacts. And so there's fewer and fewer places for these birds to go. And this migratory bird population, you know, without the Great Salt Lake, that's one fewer ecosystem in which they can survive. And so that's definitely a concern for advocates.
And I guess maybe this is a question for Jen, or I'm wondering the location of the port itself. They called it sort of the last developable chunk of Salt Lake City land, but it seems like the location could be, I mean, it is in some ways ideal because of where it is. It's close to rail, et cetera, but it has its drawbacks as well.
Well, it's a sensitive area for wildlife. And I think that when you look at the migration patterns, there's no mistaking that. It's not like you can relocate a migration point. So, I think that policymakers are going to have to be very, very careful and take some of these red flags to heart as they start to look at exactly how to mitigate these impacts.
There is Taylor, a few weeks back we spoke about the potential for a lawsuit challenging the port in general. Has that emerged from anywhere?
Not that we've seen yet. I think that it's so early in the process that the Inland Port Board may have to do something in terms of development or kind of make some action for there to be legal standing.
They need to hire an executive director still.
Yeah, but on that issue with Salt Lake City, it was Mayor Jackie Biskupski who has threatened lawsuits, or not necessarily threatened lawsuits, but said lawsuits will emerge. And kind of in this ongoing battle between the city and kind of this state body, the Salt Lake City has its own sustainability goals. It's working to decrease its own emissions and be powered more by renewables. And the city's really worried about how this is going to impact their sustainability goals. The city did have some of the political will to build their own inland port before it was kind of taken over by the state, but they really had said they were going to do this in an environmentally friendly way. And like I said, they're not sure that there's the will politically to do that now.
It's an interesting story. You can check it out at sltrib.com. There's actually a KCPW program as well that looks at this through the lens of environmental justice and where the port is located. It's In the Hive is the program, and it's an episode from a couple of weeks back. Check that out as well. We need to turn to our underplayed stories of the week to save time for a recorded feature. And Courtney Tanner, can you kick us off?
Yeah, I'm going to pick a story that Brian Mathley wrote. He's reporting on a comment that San Juan County Commissioner Rebecca Benally made during a hearing last week. She claimed that national monuments kill people. She was referring to a Navajo man that was shot by a park ranger at a national monument in Arizona. Basically, the story goes into just kind of this heated rhetoric still that exists over these national monument designations. And, you know, Rebecca Benally saying one thing, that this was an innocent man, the national park saying he had a knife. And so it's just kind of this interesting still debate that's raging over this.
Yeah, over every little thing. Well, that's not a little thing. But interesting reporting. Check it out at sltrip.com. Taylor Stevens, your pick for underplayed story.
Yeah, this is a story from Bethany Rogers, our new politics reporter. And she wrote about a mobile pot shop that's been rolling up to local high schools this week. It's been taken off the road after sparking an uproar among supporters of medical marijuana. So the truck has actually been part of a campaign against Prop 2. They're trying to highlight the flaws that they say are in the proposed ballot initiative, such as a requirement to be only 600 feet between the dispensary and a school. So it's off the road now.
It's an interesting campaign and technique to try and change minds. Jennifer Napier-Pierce, your pick for underplayed story.
I'm going to pick a story from our colleague Erin Alberti. She reported about a school, Snow Canyon High School in St. George, that has for several years sponsored the Battle of the Sexes. This week it was Men's Week, and here are some of the signs that you would see. Enter this hallway if you believe men are the superior gender. All men, underlined, are created equal. And what's a woman's point of view? The kitchen window. I mean, these are offensive. They're horrible. They're just blatantly sexist, and I think I commend the principal for putting a kibosh on that. But it's too bad. It took
as long as it did.
I know. It's been years now.
I am going to forego my underplayed story in the interest of time because we have to head to a recorded story. But Jennifer Napier Pierce, Courtney Tanner, Taylor Stevens, all with the Salt Lake Tribune, thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you. And thanks for your calls. I love hearing from people.
Me too. To close out the show, we are going to turn now to a conversation that I had with investigative science journalist Emma Penrod, whose story on water contamination around the White Mesa uranium mill appeared in the Salt Lake Tribune this week as part of a partnership the Tribune has with the Utah Investigative Journalism Project. Emma Penrod, your story about water pollution around the White Mesa uranium mill in San Juan County was published this week. Mm-hmm. In telling this story, you spoke with members of the Ute Mountain Ute tribe who live just 5 miles from this mill and who have had concerns about the mill's impact on their health for years. Mm-hmm. What is causing them concern now?
Well, there are a number of concerns that the tribe has relative to their health and the operation at the mill. Some of this has to do with water. Some of it has also had to do with air pollution, as well as there's some cultural artifact kind of issues as well. Hmm. But in this case, there's a number of pollutants that have gotten into the water, uranium and heavy metals being maybe some of the foremost issues, but also some other common pollutants. And it's not in their drinking water. They get their drinking water from a separate source. But it has entered into an aquifer and it has been detected in springs that the tribe has used for traditional purposes for many years. And there's concern that either there'll be, you know, potential health effects from being exposed to, you know, these harmful pollutants through this water, or else there's concern that they may be losing a part of, you know, access to a longtime part of their culture as a result of not being able to use this water because it's become contaminated.
Part of your reporting is about a potentially flawed construction of a sort of retention pond, a tailings pond for waste from this uranium mill. Can you summarize where this design flaw might have come from?
Yeah, in this case, and it's worth noting that the situation that I've investigated specifically, this particular tailings pond is not currently in use. It's not containing waste, at least. So it's not likely the source of the current contamination.
Okay.
But there was a contractor who had been hired to excavate the cell and build, you know, basically he calls it a big bathtub in the ground that they were going to put the cells in and then put the waste in and cover it up with water, you know, and keep it from blowing around and things.
Yeah.
And as he was doing this, they repeatedly asked him to change the way that he was building this tailing cell, that he was digging this hole, and especially the way he would treat this after the hole was dug to make sure that there was a smooth lining at the bottom. Mm-hmm. If there wasn't a smooth lining, there was some possibility it'd poke a hole in the plastic cover that they would put underneath the bottom to make sure nothing leaks, and then it might leak.
Right.
And because of some conversations with some engineers that he had, as well as other issues, he had become concerned that the cell may have been built in such a way that it could potentially collapse under the weight of the water and the waste that would be put into the cell, causing the liner to tear and potentially causing additional leaks in the future.
And then, okay, so that's, all right, a problem.
Very abbreviated version.
No, it's good, it's a problem with what, you know, the future of this mill might have when it comes to how it maintains waste. Meanwhile, there are these older retention ponds that could also conceivably be leaching contaminants into the ground. Is that right?
Yeah, there are three older cells on site. There are various environmental groups, as well as the tribe, have some concerns that may be where this contamination in the groundwater could be coming from, or where it could be a potential source in the future. They kind of see the evidence suggesting that these newer cells were built improperly as a possible indicator of, well, if this wasn't built correctly, how do we know the old ones were built properly?
There's a bit of a difference of opinion, though, on where contamination that is in the groundwater is coming from. The
yes.
tribe has an environmental programs director. He points to the mill, to the uranium mill. Mm-hmm. And then there's a state official with the Division of Waste Management and Radiation Control. He has a different answer from where contaminants are getting into the water. What's the essence of that difference of opinion?
Yeah, I mean, if you ask them, you know, or is this groundwater coming from the mill, they'll kind of initially, my experience has been they'll initially kind of tell you, well, no, it's all these other things. But then when you push them on it, they'll be like, well, yeah, okay, so that specific pollutant, that came from an old operation prior to the mill, and we're working on it. Hmm. And then you're like, well, but then what about this one? And like, that one was related to some other operations going on at the mill site, but it's not coming from the tailings cell. It's some other operations.
Yeah.
And so it's, you know, it's not as clear cut, really. It's not necessarily that they're saying that, oh, this is absolutely not the mill once they're pressed on it.
Yeah.
But they're very resistant to the idea that the tailings cells have leaked and caused the groundwater contamination.
Scott Clow, who he is the Ute Mountain Ute Tribe's environmental analysis expert, he points to a sort of moving the goalposts tactic from state regulators. And this has to do with levels of, mm-hmm. Say, metals that naturally mm-hmm. occur in groundwater in the area. Explain that, if you will, Emma, because it comes back around to the uranium mill and basically the baseline of uranium that's there.
Yes. When you would have an operation like this, you'd want to make sure that, you know, that it's not leaking into the groundwater, right? You want to make sure that any industrial operation you're having is not causing this contamination. But in an area like this that is, you know, it's the mill's there because there's uranium mines there because there's uranium naturally right. occurring in the ground and in the rock. So you would have to go in and do a study and establish this is the natural amount of uranium that would naturally normally be in the groundwater so that we can then monitor to make sure that it's not being added to by, you know, human activity.
Right.
And so the tribe's allegations were that when these levels of uranium in particular have been found to be increasing in the groundwater near the mill, the state has gone in and simply said, oh, you know what, it turns out that the old baseline that we had established was not correct. And they changed the baseline and say, actually, we believe that this higher level is natural. And I was able to find, you know, a letter from the state to the uranium mill's owners in which they did, you know, there had been an increase of uranium in the groundwater. And the mill had come back and said, we don't think it's us. We think it's natural. And the state said, yeah, we agree with you. And we're going to revise the level.
Is it that they think that the uranium levels themselves have naturally been increasing in the area, or that the baseline was always higher than they suspected? I mean, is there such a thing as natural increase in baseline uranium levels happening of its
right.
own accord?
Yeah. And so it depends on the specific situation. There's situations with like the acidity in the groundwater that is kind of a natural situation, kind of a not natural situation, where they acknowledge that the mill had pumped water out of the aquifer, which caused additional acid to leach into the water. Hmm. But, you know, they still feel like that's natural because the acidic minerals that caused that were natural to the area. So you have that kind of situation. You also have situations where they move these baselines, you know, saying, you know what, we believe that the baseline was incorrect to begin with.
Hmm. So it's both.
Which, yes, so it's both. And that is an issue here. You know, we don't know historically, because this site has been used for industrial purposes for quite a while, we don't know exactly what the natural situation was.
The tribe also points out that it's been there for a lot longer than the mill or for, mm-hmm. you know, or than anyone else for that matter. This just speaks to a kind of political question at the same time, because the owners of this mill had a hand in advocating for downsizing the Bears
they
Ears
did.
National Monument. This is a move that President Trump made last year. It's still being challenged in the courts. Mm-hmm. What was the company's role in that whole process?
Well, the Washington Post had found emails from the mill's owners to actually, I believe, state leaders, which then led to the lobbying, or at least in part led to the lobbying effort that caused the reduction in Bears Ears, which would have been very, very close to their mill.
Hmm. This is Colorado-based Energy Fuels Resources.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So what does the tribe want to see happen when it comes to the mill and groundwater contamination? And what about the mill owners and the state? What do they want to see? What's the exit from this problem of contaminated groundwater here?
That is a hard question. I'm not sure they know the answers for sure. The tribe indicated to me that their ideal situation is that they would like to see this facility closed.
Hmm.
But if it closes, that doesn't actually remove the contamination. Somebody still has to clean that up, and there's significant questions as to whether the funds have been held in bonds that would be adequate to actually clean the site up upon the mill's closure. That's a big dispute right now. Mm. So there's that issue. The other thing that the tribe has asked is that the three older tailing cells be taken out of production and all of the waste moved into newer, more sustainable, ideally, cells. There has been a proposal that has just been put in for this, you know, company to build two new cells on site. Mm-hmm. So maybe there's some movement on that front. Hard to say as far as that. You know, the mill probably hopes to continue operating and, right. You know, they continue to hold that they are in compliance with all regulations and that they are heavily regulated and therefore that it ought to be a protective situation of the environment there and of the people who live there.
Hmm. And they point to their what they do as being a sort of national security asset.
They do, because they are among, you know, the last facilities even capable of taking raw uranium ore, which they actually don't do terribly often, and milling it into, you know, usable yellowcake, you know, uranium that's then sent to energy and weapons products. It's worth noting that a large portion of their business is not actually in, you know, milling this raw ore at this point, but it is actually in taking what they call alternative feeds, which is where they take in materials that have been contaminated by uranium and they kind of recycle them, as it were.
To extract.
And extract that uranium and probably get paid to take those materials off certain entities' hands. So, because the price of uranium has not been so great in recent years, it's not a good business. That is another thing that these guys have had a hand in, is that they are pushing for tariffs to be put on foreign imports of uranium to try to bring up the prices for, you know, their own product.
Hmm. But again, I mean, you pointed out the tribe wants to see this mill closed. From what you're describing, that doesn't seem like a likely scenario in the near future.
Who knows?
Who knows? Okay. You can check out the story, listeners, at sltrib.com. It raises as many questions as it answers. And Emma, how can people find more of the science journalism that you do?
Yeah, so I produce a weekly newsletter on the politics and science of water. That's available through a new journalism website called Pactio. That's P-A-C-T-I-O.
Okay.
So if you go there, you look me up, you can sign up there for my weekly newsletter, as well as check out some of my previous coverage, which has been posted there.
Okay. Emma Penrod, investigative science journalist, thank you very much for telling us this story.
Thank you.
Emma Penrod's story on water contamination around the White Mesa uranium mill appears in the Salt Lake Tribune this week as part of a partnership the Tribune has with the Utah Investigative Journalism Project. Check out her story and all of the stories we've been covering at sltrib.com. That does it for Behind the Headlines. Thanks again for listening. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week.